I was saying that the Jews and the teachers of the church that became established or rather controlled after the death of my followers, and those who understood the true teachings of my disciples, taught the conduct of men towards their fellowmen, and the observance of certain ceremonies and feasts were the important things for men to learn and practice in order to gain salvation, rather than the truths which made man a child of the Father and at one with him through the operations of the new birth. Of course, before my coming, the Jews could not have taught the truth of the new birth, because the great gift of the re-bestowal of the divine love had not been made, and it was not possible for that great truth, which was necessary for immortality and the possibility of man's partaking of God's divine love, to be known to 307, the Jews, and hence, they could not teach it, and their teachings were limited and confined to the things which would make them purer in their natural love and in the relation of that love to the Father. God, at that time, while he never gave them the privilege of becoming at one with him in the divine love or even of becoming such beings in their character and spiritual qualities as were Adam and Eve, commonly supposed to be our first parents, yet did require of them obedience to his laws which would develop in them their natural love to such a degree, as would cause it to become in harmony with his laws that controlled and governed their natural love. If you will study the Ten Commandments, you will see that these commandments deal only with the natural love, and by their observance would tend to make men better in that natural love and in their conduct with one another and in their relationship to God, so far as that love brought them in communion with him. This natural love, as I have said, was possessed by men, just as the first parents possessed it, and was never taken from them, and in its purity was in perfect harmony with God's creation and the workings of his universe, but notwithstanding these great qualities men were mere men and had in them no part of the divinity of the Father. And this being so, the Jews, while they were supposed to be more in contact with God through the prophets and seers, than were any of the other races or sects of God's children, yet, never looked for a Messiah that would come with any other or greater power than that which would enable them to become the great ruling nation of the earth, to whom all other peoples would be subordinated and subjected, and powerless to ever again conquer or subject their nation to bondage. In a way, this Messiah was to be a kind of supernatural being, having power which no other man ever had, and a kind of God to be worshipped and served in their earthly lives. Many of the Jews, notwithstanding what may be said to the contrary in the teachings of the prophets, believed in other gods than the one which Moses declared, as is evidenced in their histories, both sacred and secular, for whenever their God, that is, the God of Moses, did not treat them just as they thought he should, they would create and worship other gods, even the golden calf. So I say they never expected a Messiah who would be other than a most powerful ruler on earth. The Paget Messages 1916. Their ideas and beliefs of the life after death were very hazy, and even that part of them known as the Pharisees, who believed in a kind of resurrection, never conceived that when they should drop the mortal life, they would be anything different in their qualities and characters from what they were as mortals, minus the physical bodies, and the great increased happiness which would come to them as such mortals, changed in their appearances. This was the idea of the common people and also of the priests and scribes, and notwithstanding the many beautiful and spiritual psalms ascribed to David, the happiness or glory that they might expect, was only that which would come to them as spiritualized mortals having only the natural love. So you see, the great gift of the Father that is the re-bestowal of the divine love, was not known or even dreamed of by the Jews, nor conceived of nor taught by their scribes, nor even by their great prophets, or lawgivers such as Moses and Elias and others. Their conception of God was that of an exalted personal being, all-powerful and all-knowing, and one whom they would be able to see face to face, as they might any king or ruler when they should come into the heavens which he had prepared for them, and where he had his habitation. I will defer the writing until later, Jesus. January 12, 1916. I am here, Jesus. I will continue my discourse. As I was saying, the chief object of my mission on earth was to teach the re-bestowal of the divine love upon man and the way to obtain it, and the secondary object was to teach men those moral truths which would tend to make them better in their conduct towards their fellow men and purer in their natural love. And so it is, that in my teachings of these moral truths, the effect of these teachings was to bring man more in harmony with the laws of the Father, which control the operations of the natural love. I never at any time intended that men should understand that these moral truths would bring about their union with the Father in the divine sense, or that the possession of this natural love in its purest state would enable man to become a partaker of God's divine nature, or an inhabitant of his kingdom. But as I have said, the only object apparently that these compilers and writers of the Bible had to 308, accomplish, was to persuade men that the observance of these moral teachings in their conduct was all that was necessary to enable them to enter the kingdom of heaven. I know that it is said that love and almsgiving and kind deeds will work to a man's salvation and enable him to become at one with the Father and to enjoy the presence of God in the high heavens, but this is not true. The good deeds which men perform in the way of helping his fellow man will live after him, and will undoubtedly work towards a man becoming perfect in his natural love, but they will not bring that man in atonement with the Father in the higher love which is so necessary to his full salvation. My messages to you, while they will not take one jot or tittle from the moral teachings, yet they will show to man the necessity and way to obtain a full reconciliation with the Father and a home in the celestial spheres. I will come to you again and write upon a subject which is important to you, and which men should understand. So with all my love I will say good night. Your brother and friend, Jesus. January 13, 1916. I am here, Luke. I want to tell you tonight of the mystery of the birth of the soul and the human being. All souls which enter into mortal bodies are, previous to such advent, real, living existences, and made in the likeness of the great soul, though not having the qualities and potentialities of that soul, and also, not having the form of individualized personality that they have after they become parts of the composition, or form, of the mortal and spiritual bodies of human beings. The soul, in its existence prior to becoming an indweller in the mortal body, has a consciousness of its existence and of its relationship to God and to other parts of the great soul, and more especially of the duplex character of its being, and by this I mean the sexual differences in the two parts of the soul, which, in the way that they are united, constitutes the one complete soul. When the time comes for this soul to become an indweller in the mortal frame, the two parts that I speak of separate, and only one of the parts enters at the same time into a mortal and never into the same mortal, and while this separation is necessary for the individualization of each part of the Paget Messages 1916, this one complete soul, yet the two parts never lose that interrelationship, or the binding qualities that existed before their separation, and which continue to exist thereafter, and in the great future, after the work of individualization shall be completed, will come together again and reunite in a complete one. This separation may exist a longer or shorter time, depending upon the similar development of those similar qualities that is absolutely necessary in order that this coming together in the original one, as it were, may take place. While, as I have said, this soul before its separation has a consciousness of its existence, and when its duplex character leaves it, or rather leaves the two separated parts, and thereafter, until its re-entrance into the spirit world, does not again return to these parts. But in order to regain this consciousness, it is not necessary that both of these parts at the same time shall come again into the spirit life, for if one part becomes a spirit, free from the physical body, and the other part remains in the mortal body, that part that comes into the spirit world may receive the awakening to this consciousness, depending upon certain conditions and developments. It often happens that both these parts will return to the spirit world, and yet, for a long time, live as spirits without having a restoration of this consciousness, because of various reasons that may exist. The conditions of the development of the two parts may be so vastly different that the realization of this consciousness may be wholly impossible, and very often it is the case that when these two individualized parts are informed that they are the soulmates of each other, they will not believe that information, and live on in utter indifference to the fact. But ultimately, the consciousness of their relationship will come to them, because their development, no matter whether intellectual or spiritual, will tend towards the awakening of this consciousness, which is always present with them, although dormant. Now, as to what this soul is in its constituent parts or shape or form prior to its separation for the purpose of becoming an inhabitant of the mortal body, we spirits are not informed and do not know. We are often present at the conception, and also the birth of a child, and realize that a soul has become enveloped in the flesh, but we cannot see that soul as it enters into that home of mortal environment, because as to us it is invisible and has no form, but after its lodgment in the human body we can perceive it and realize its existence, for then 309, it assumes a form, and that form varies in different incarnations, or in the incarnations in different humans. We have never seen the soul of God, although we know that there is this great oversoul, and hence we cannot see the soul of any image of the great soul until it becomes, as I say, individualized. I know that men have often wondered and asked the question as to the preexistence of the soul that has been incarnated, and what qualities and attributes it had during its preexistence, and as to these particulars I wish to say, that we spirits, although we are inhabitants of God's celestial heavens, have little information, though we know that the soul, and I mean the complete soul in oneness, has an existence prior to its becoming individualized. You may ask how we know this? Well, it will be hard to explain this to you, so that you may comprehend, but this I can say, that we spirits of the higher soul development can, by our soul perceptions, understand the existence of these souls as images of the great soul, and the qualities of these images are such, that while we cannot sensibly, as you would say, see these souls or their dualities, yet we are conscious of their existence. To use an illustration, that is not altogether appropriate, you understand that the wind blows, yet you cannot see it. And we further understand, and such is the result of our observations, that when the soul, and keep in mind that I mean the two parts when I say soul, once becomes incarnated and assumes an individualized form, it never thereafter loses that individuality, and hence, never again returns to its condition of preexistence, and can never again become reincarnated in the existence of any human being. There is no such thing as reincarnation, and all the theories and speculations of men upon that question, which conclude that a soul once incarnated can again become incarnated, are wrong, for the incarnation of a soul is only one step in its destined progress from an invisible formless existence to a glorious angel or to a perfected spirit. A soul in this progress never retraces its steps, it is always progress, though sometimes stagnation takes place, but continues as an individualized spirit until it reaches its goal in fulfillment of the Father's plan for the perfecting of His universe. This is a subject that is difficult of treatment for several reasons, among which is the fact that we spirits, no matter how high our attainments, do not have the information in order to give a full and, the Paget Messages 1916, complete description of the soul and its qualities prior to its incarnation. And you mortals are not capable of comprehending the full truth as we may try to convey it to you. I have made this effort to give you some faint idea of the soul, as you are in good condition tonight to receive my ideas, but I realize how inadequate my attempt has proved to be. But from it, you can understand that the soul has an existence prior to its finding its home in the physical body, that it is duplex and has a consciousness of the relationship of its two parts, that after it has received the experience of the mortal life and received an individuality, it returns to the spirit world, and that at some time that consciousness will come to it again, and the two parts will become one, unless in the development of these separate parts have arisen barriers that may prevent their reuniting. And further, that this soul will never again retrace the steps of its progression and become reincarnated. I will now close, and with my love and blessings say good night. Your brother in Christ, Luke. January 15, 1916. I am here, Jesus. I come tonight to tell you that you are in a very much better condition than you have been for some time, and your rapport with us is so very much greater, that I feel that I should write you a message upon an important subject which is vital to the salvation of man from the sins and errors of his life on earth. And I will write a portion of what I desire to write. Well, I will first say that there are so many men and women on the earth, who believe, or assert that they believe, that through their own efforts they can develop those soul qualities which are necessary to bring them in accord with the soul of the Father, that I find that the task of convincing these persons of the errors of their beliefs, or assumption of beliefs, will be a very great one. This task will not be confined to those who have given real and deep study to the mysteries of life, both on earth and thereafter, but also to a much greater number who have a kind of smattering of this supposed knowledge, which the wiser or more learned publish to the world as a result of their investigations. It is more difficult to convince the ignorant, who think that they know the laws of being and the plan of the workings of God's universe, than to convince those who have given sincere thoughtful 310 study to the same, because the latter, generally, as they progress in their investigations become convinced that the more they should know as a result of their investigations, the less they really know. I do not know just what is the most important subject for comment tonight relating to these matters, for there are so many, all of which I must at same time instruct you about. But I will write tonight about the relationship of man to the creation of the world, and the origin of life. Your Bible says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," etc., out of a void, and continued that creation until there was a perfect heaven with all its glories, and a perfect earth with inhabitants of every kind, all perfect and made just as an all-wise and all-powerful God would create, and as a climax to all, man, who was so perfect that he was made in the image of his Creator. Well, this story is just as good and satisfactory as any that has been conceived and written by man, and is just as worthy of belief, but as a fact it is not true, for there never was a time or period when there was a void in the universe or when there was chaos. God never created anything out of nothing, but his creations, such as are perceived by and known to men, were merely the change in form or composition of what had already existed, and always will exist as elements, though there will undoubtedly be changes in form and appearance and in constituent elements in their relation to one another. God was always existent, a being without beginning, which idea the finite mind, I know, cannot grasp, but it is true, and so also everything which is in the universe today always existed, though not in form and composition as they now are. And as they are, they will not continue to be, for change eternal is the law of his universe. I mean as to all things which may be spoken of as having a substance, whether they be material or ethereal. Of course, his truths never change, and neither do the laws by which the harmony of the universe is preserved and continued perfect. Now, the earth on which you live did not always have an existence, as an earth, and neither did the firmament and the great galaxy of planets and stars, but they were not created out of nothing, and neither was the chaos, for in God's economy of being there is never any chaos, which if it should be, would mean the absence of the workings of his laws and harmony. The Paget Messages 1916, but the earth and the firmament were created. At one time they had no existence as such, and at a coming time they may cease to have such existence. And this creation was in an orderly way, according to design, with no element of chance entering into it, and such creation was not through what your wise men may call accretion or evolution, that is self-evolution, for every new or additional exponent of growth or manifestations of increase was the result of God's laws, which he operated in the creation of the creature. There is no such thing as self-evolution, or that development which arises from the unassisted growth of the thing developed, and this applies to all nature as well as to man. To grow, to become nearer perfection, implies the decay and disappearance or some elements which have performed their missions and work in the growth of the thing created, and never do the same elements continue in the development of that which the laws in their operations bring to greater and greater perfection. But in all this work of creation there are laws of disintegration and apparent retrogression operating, as well as laws of positive construction and advancement, and again these former laws do not operate by chance, but by design just as do the latter class of laws. The All-Creator knows, when for the purpose of bringing forth the perfect creature, be it man or animal or vegetable or mineral, the laws of decay and retrogression as well as the laws of advancement and increased effectiveness shall operate, and he never makes a mistake in setting into operation these laws, and never pronounces the result of his work not good. As has been said, 1,000 years are as a day with God, and while for many long years it may appear to man, there are retrogression and delay in bringing to perfection a creature of the Creator's works, yet that apparent retrogression is not such a fact, but only a course or method adopted for bringing forth the higher or greater perfection. I know it is difficult to explain these workings of creation to the finite, earthy mind, but you may grasp some conception of what I desire to make known. Man, in his creation, was not the slow growth as were some of the other creations of God, but it was from and at the beginning made perfect, with the exception of the qualities of divinity and immortality. He did not grow from a lower creature, as some of your scientists have proclaimed, by the slow process of evolution, and 311, this is self-evolution, resulting from inherent qualities which were developed by experience, but he was created the perfect man. I will stop for the present. Your brother and friend, Jesus. January 16, 1916. I am here, Hannah Somerville. I am the spirit of one who lived on earth the life of a leader of a sect that believed in the resurrection of the body and the eternal punishment of those who refused to believe in the vicarious atonement of Jesus and his sacrificial death. I have been in the spirit world a great many years, and have been long ago learned the great errors of my beliefs and teachings, and now know that the earthly body does not rise again and Jesus did not make a vicarious atonement, nor did his death on the cross satisfy the justice and demands of an angry God. I know that other spirits have written you this same denial of a false belief, but I wanted to do so also, for I realize to such a great extent how harmful such beliefs are. I was in the spirit world a long time before I was relieved of these beliefs, and I stood still in my progress for many years waiting to be called to heaven and to meet my Lord face to face, and receive from him the great commendation of, "Well done, good and faithful servant." But I received no such call, and I never got any nearer to God, apparently, than when I first entered the spirit world. And all this time I was in such a condition that I was not susceptible to the teachings of other spirits who know the truth and attempted to show me the errors of my belief. This may seem strange to you, but I want to tell you that the conviction of a strong belief is one that is not easily removed or shaken, and I did not find any greater and convincing force in the assertions and arguments of spirits than I would have found in the arguments of mortals, had I remained on earth. I saw many spirits and talked with them, and they told me that Jesus was not God, but merely a spirit like myself, only the perfect one, but I could not believe, for my earth belief could not be shaken. I even saw a spirit who said he was Jesus and that I must not believe in him as God, or in any vicarious atonement, but yet I could not be convinced of my errors. The Paget Messages 1916. This earth belief is a wonderful thing when it once possesses a man as it did me, and so many spirits have suffered from it, as I suffered. At last the light came to me, and my soul was set free to progress to the higher spheres. But how much time I lost, and how much unhappiness I needlessly endured I cannot tell you. Now I am in a celestial sphere, where I know that Jesus made no vicarious atonement and is not God, but my loving elder brother. I have never written before and I wanted very much to write, and your band was kind enough to let me do so. My name was Hannah Somerville, and I lived in England, and died in 1682. I have forgotten the name, but it was a sect of dissenters. Yes, and I have given you my correct name. Yes, I can. I believe and know that Jesus was and is the Son of God, and the most beloved Son, too. I will say good night, Hannah Somerville. I am here, St. Paul, of the New Testament. I come tonight to tell you of a truth that is important for men to know, and which you must place in your book of truths. I have written you before on my alleged writings as they are contained in the Bible, and which, as I have said, were not written by me as they there appear. I desire tonight to write for a short time on the subject of the resurrection, because, as I see, the church doctrine of the resurrection is founded more on what is ascribed to me than on the writings of the Gospels, though the latter also contain a basis for the doctrine. I never said there would be a resurrection of the physical body nor of the individual clothed in any body of flesh, but my teachings were that man at death would rise in a spiritual body, and that not a new one made for the special occasion of his departure from the material body, but one that had been with him through life and that came into an individualized form when he first became a living being. This spirit body is necessary to man's existence, and is that part of him which contains his senses and is the seat of his reasoning powers. Of course, the organs of the physical are necessary for the utilization of these senses, and without these organs there could be no manifestations of the senses, which are inherent in the spirit body. Even if a man should lose the perfect workings of his physical organs of sight, yet the power of seeing would still exist in him, although he might not be able to realize that fact. 312, and this same principle applies to the hearing and the other senses. So when man loses his physical organs which are necessary for him to see with, he is dead as to sight, just as dead as he ever becomes with reference to all the other organs of sense when the whole physical body dies, and were it possible to restore these physical organs that are necessary to enable him to see or hear, he would be able to see and hear just as he was before their loss. The restoration of these organs does not, of itself, bring him the power to see and hear, but merely enables the faculties of sight and hearing to again use the organs for the purpose of manifesting the powers which are in and a part of the spirit body. When the whole physical body dies, the spirit body, at the very time of death, becomes resurrected, and with all these faculties of which I have spoken, and thereafter continues to live free and unencumbered from the material body, which, these organs being destroyed, can no longer perform the objects of its creation. It becomes dead, and thereafter never has any resurrection as such material body, although its elements or parts do not die, but in the workings of God's laws enter upon other and new functioning, though never that of reuniting and forming again the body that has died. So the resurrection of the body, as taught by me, is the resurrection of the spiritual body, not from death, for it never dies, but from its envelopment in a material form which had been visible as a thing of apparent life. There is a law controlling the uniting of the two bodies and the functioning of the powers and faculties of the spirit body through the organs of the physical body, that limits the extent of the operations of these faculties, to those things that are wholly material, or which have the appearance of the material, and when I say material I mean that which is grosser or more compact than the spirit body. Thus these faculties of sight of the spirit body can, through the organs of the material body, see what are called ghosts or apparitions as well as the more material things, but never, in this way, see things of pure spirit. And when it is said that men or women see clairvoyantly, which they do, it is not meant or is it a fact, that they see through the organs of the physical eyes, but on the contrary, this sight is one purely spiritual, and its workings are entirely independent of the material organs. Now when this body, the material, dies, the spirit body becomes resurrected, as it is said, and, the Paget Messages 1916, free from all the limitations which its incarnation in the flesh has imposed, and it is then able to use all its faculties without the limitations or help of the physical organs, and, as regards the sight, everything in nature, both material and spiritual, becomes the object of its vision, and that which the limitations of the material organs prevented its seeing, and which to men is the unreal and non-existent becomes the real and truly existing. This, in short, is what I meant by the resurrection of the body, and from this you will realize that the resurrection is not to take place at some unknown day in the future, but at the very moment when the physical body dies, and, as the Bible says, in the twinkling of an eye. This saying of the Bible attributed to me, I did write and teach. This resurrection applies to all mankind, for all who have ever lived and died have been resurrected, and all who shall live hereafter and die will be resurrected. But this resurrection is not the great resurrection upon which, in my teachings, I declared the great truth of Christianity to be founded. This is not the resurrection of Jesus that I declared, without which is our faith, as Christian, is vain. This is the common resurrection, applicable to all mankind of every nation and race, whether they have knowledge of Jesus or not. And many times in many nations has it been demonstrated before the coming of Jesus, that men had died and appeared again as living spirits in the form of angels and men, and were recognized by mortal men as spirits who had a previous earth existence. So I say, this is the resurrection common to all men, and the coming and death and resurrection of Jesus, as taught by the churches, did not bring the great resurrection to the knowledge or comfort of men, and did not furnish the true foundation upon which the true Christian belief and faith rest.